Hi, y'all. This is Kristen Chenoweth.
Hi, I'm Gloria Stefan.
This is Sarah Bareilles.
Hi, I'm Patti LuPone.
This is Lin-Manuel Miranda. You're listening to the Broadway Podcast Network.
Welcome to the Theater Podcast, intimate personal conversations with the industry's biggest names. I'm your host, Alan Seals, and our guest today is none other than Eva Noblezada, who is currently starring as Eurydice in Hadestown on Broadway. She was shot out of a cannon at age 17 after being one of the finalists in the Jimmy Awards, and then was flown across the ocean to star as the lead in the first ever revival of Miss Saigon. When she was 18, she was in a country where everything is legal at the age of 18 with a huge paycheck from being a lead on the West End and thrust into the spotlight and became an instant celebrity. And it just took a number on her. And now after some self-reflection, she has figured out who she wants to be, isn't afraid to accept who she is in the moment. And we just had a very real, authentic conversation. Eva, thank you so much for being truthful. And we cover a bunch of things, including her own journey through therapy and eating disorders. So a little bit of a trigger warning. We do talk about bulimia as well. So be careful for that. Find me online, Instagram and Twitter at @theater_podcast. Share this podcast with a friend, you know? Help it grow. Help the word get out. Help spread these amazing stories. Find me online at bpn.fm/TTP. And now, everybody, please enjoy this episode with Eva Noblezada.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. From the launch your online shop stage, all the way to the we just hit a million orders stage. No matter what stage you're in, Shopify's there to help you grow. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/special offer, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/special offer.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Here you go, 1, 2, 3.
Today's guest is a 2-time Tony Award nominee, Grammy Award winner, What's on Stage Award winner, and Jimmy Award winner, and she's only 25. After winning the Jimmy Awards in 2013, she began her professional theatrical career first in London in Les Mis before starring as the friggin' lead at age 17, by the way, in the first ever revival of Miss Saigon. Among many notable performances, she's also starred in the film Yellow Rose and can now be seen way underground in Hadestown as Eurydice on Broadway. Eva Noblezada, welcome to the Theater Podcast.
Thank you for having me, Theater Podcast, and Alan.
Well, I actually said you're 25 in your in the intro there, but by the time this airs, you're going to be 26. So
I'll be 26. Happy. And also, fun fact, I didn't actually win the Jimmy Awards.
Well, you didn't?
No, then Sarah Lynn Marion won the Jimmy Awards.
Then what's on? Then Wikipedia
you can't trust Wikipedia. People go on there and say stuff all the time. Did you see what they put for Julia Fox's Wikipedia page?
No.
They put that she is what Josh Safdie's name for Uncut Gems. They put that. Have you seen that going around? Yeah, Wikipedia isn't always right. But yeah.
All right. All right. Well, thank you for the correction. I'll go back and update Wikipedia here once it's all done.
So. That's great.
Cool. So yeah. God, you have done so much in such a short amount of time, and it kind of just shot you out of a cannon. I think that's probably, I mean, we'll get to all this stuff, but like, let's start back at the very beginning and tell me about, like, when you were growing up, were you always into performing? Were you into singing as a child?
Yeah, I always make the joke that I came out of my mom singing, which is really gross if you think about it. But yeah, I think I always just had a desire to perform, but just like be in something. Maybe that's why I have such FOMO as an adult, but I just like being a part of like grand stories or just like the vibe of like people coming over to our house for dinner, or like, you know, as growing up Filipino Mexican, like always there's people that are family coming over for dinner or friends coming over for dinner. So that vibe of like people and like wanting to like entertain and like storytelling and fun, like I was like, that was like crack for me as a child. And so really honed my addiction to like entertaining, I guess. Well, but yeah, I was always singing for sure.
So then, I guess Filipino Mexican, that was the heritage. And you grew up in California?
Yes. Born and raised in the 619.
I can trust that fact. Okay.
Yeah.
So then California, and then you came to, what was it, Northwest School of the Arts in Charlotte?
Yeah.
North Carolina?
Charlotte, North Carolina. I love Bojangles. I love the mountains, and I love Northwest School of the Arts. That's what I'm talking about.
I'm from North Wilkesboro originally, which I don't know if you know that.
Oh, wow. I know that. I never went off that exit, but I know that's like on the way to Greensboro, right?
Yeah, like if you're going north up I-77.
I-77. That's what it is. Yes.
So, yeah, you could either go, you could go west to Wilkesboro or east to Winston and Greensboro. So,
oh my God, I see the freaking freeway sign in my head. I know exactly where that is. So great.
Yep. Bojangles, you are speaking to my soul right now, which, side note, I just read an article yesterday saying that they're going to do this big expansion up here and they're going to have locations in Jersey.
Oh, that's still too far away for me.
Yeah, I'm going to come get you. We're going to go because like every weekend I want this four-piece supreme dinner.
Oh, dang it. Yeah. You know what I miss is the Bowberry biscuits. I haven't had those in years. I used to get like two at a time and just like, yeah, that was the best life.
Sweet tea. I went to NC State. In college, my roommates, my sweet mates and I, we would go to Bojangles probably 8 times a week to eat.
Well, you know, you got to do what you got to do.
Right?
To survive. And it makes you happy. So live your life.
Oh God. It's fucking happy, dude. That place. I am so obsessed with that place. And we could spend the next hour talking about Bojangles.
Yeah.
But we won't. So then going back to you, Miss Four Piece Supreme Dinner. So then at what point did you realize that you wanted to make performing a career? Because a lot of people, you know, like attention and they like to there's a validation in being on stage and telling stories or whatever the case is. But then at what point were you like, you know what, I'm going to audition for this school and go all the way across the country in high school, which by the way, seems kind of insane.
Yeah, ridiculous. We moved when I was like 8 or 9 to Charlotte and we moved to Mooresville first. And I hadn't actually... I wanted to be an opera singer first because it was the first sort of theater that involved singing that I was like introduced to. It didn't even cross my mind to like have a career in just singing because I just loved entertaining and I tried to build a freaking stage when I was like 5 years old in my papa's backyard, had like a hammer and nails. And I was like in like, you know, very unsupervised as a kid, which kind of was awesome. But anyway, it wasn't until I was reconnected with my auntie, Annette, who was actually in Sesame Street. She was in one of the casts of Miss Saigon on Broadway. She really was the first person to truly introduce me to musical theater. And then once that snowball started rolling down the hill, I realized my dad had a freaking bachelor's degree as a music teacher. He plays saxophone. So he started to like, even when we were in San Diego, he would like sit me by the piano and we would do our arpeggios and do like all of our warm-ups and stuff. And so musical theater wasn't introduced to me until I was like 10. And then the Northwest School of the Arts is actually a middle school, high school, which is even better. So it's a way bigger group of ages. And so I auditioned and got in and I started going there when I was in sixth grade.
The sixth, seventh, eighth grade years, I mean, being a teenager alone is bad enough. But then you throw in all of the competitiveness and the uncertainty and anxiety around the performing arts as well. So, my God, right? How I guess you're going to middle school and most people's normal does not involve the anxiety of where am I going to get my next job? Where am I going to get my next performing attribution from, right? So then all of a sudden you're thrust into this world. Like, did your normal shift at that point, or did you know it was sort of out of the ordinary?
I did, only because my parents were so young. They really wanted me to go for a career that was like financially set. Like, it's always a joke in the Filipino world, like, you have to become a doctor or a nurse or a lawyer or a real estate agent. You know, it's the joke, because like, that is a job that is known for getting you a very fixed and great income. Mm-hmm. But I just was really fucking bored. I was like, why the fuck would I want to be a doctor if I have no like desire to go to medical school? And I did think about these things at a young age, because like, people were always talking about it. And like, what sucks about the education system is that it's so set for you. And it doesn't actually ask you questions of like, what would you like to do? What would you like to pursue? You can make money off that. And this is how you can do that. It's very much like, you have to go to college, you have to do this, and then you get a job. Because you graduate college and you have a degree, that gets you a job. And I started seeing it from early age. I was like, oh, but it doesn't. Like, you get a BFA in musical theater that doesn't actually prompt you. You're not promised a job once you graduate college, even though you went through all those years of school. So I don't know. I always knew that I was going to do it. So I guess I was extremely naive, but also really passionate. And I'm a really hard fucking worker. So that kind of crazy concoction just gave me a lot of confidence going in to be like, if I get rejection, that's fine. It doesn't take away from my talent. I just keep working and keep trying to get to where I want to be.
Really? At that young age, like, you still had the wherewithal to be like, rejection is cool?
If you met my dad, you'd be like, oh yeah, no wonder. Because I did a lot of sports actually before I got onto musical theater. It took years to truly convince my parents, like, let me fully do theater. Let me fully sing. Because I did basketball, I did paintball, I did BMX, I did volleyball. I did all the sports you can imagine. My dad was like, we wanted a boy. We wanted an athlete. And you came first, God damn it. But yeah, I did all the sports. And in those sports too, I was like, I was a beast at those sports. Even basketball, even though I'm like 5 foot, well, I'll lie, I'm 5'4". there I am. But yeah, my dad always gave me the really just implanted that disgustingly awesome work ethic. Like, my brain was constantly like a Nike ad campaign. And then I brought that mindset into musical theater at a young age, which I think gave me a really good head start.
Yeah. Wow. I feel like there's a lot of kids, and call them kids, right? Middle school and high school, that just take everything so personally, and gosh, not even kids, adults, right?
Yeah. Right.
Well, like, yeah. Oh, man. And that's one of the things that, I guess I've learned through almost 200 full episodes of this podcast. Now it's taken me this long to realize it, right? That you have to embrace what makes you different, and rejection doesn't mean you weren't good enough. You're like, the job was never yours. I think it was.
Yeah, nothing's promised to you. Nothing.
It was Michael Urie, I think, that said it to me. It was like, why do you feel bad about not getting the job? The job was never yours.
I love Michael Urie.
Yeah.
Yeah, so but it's kind of stupid that I had such confidence then, and now I'm just like, such a fucking crybaby now about everything. Yeah, it's funny.
Well, oh God, we're going to get to that. Life is mid-20s and Broadway life combined again. Another concoction that is just going to send people to therapy.
That's not a concoction. But, that's a full-on absinthe cocktail. That's just like XO. You're done. Fucking ruins you.
Dude, while you've got your job, you're still looking for your next job and more work, because you just never know the anxiety
you
around
never
this
know,
lifestyle.
Especially after the pandemic. And what really pisses me off is when people are like, so what are you doing next? I'm like, motherfucker, what do you mean what I'm doing next? Like, I'm doing 8 shows a week. Is that enough for you? Like, that really makes me laugh. I spend too much time thinking about what other people think. And it makes sense, because it's kind of a part of our industry. Like,
this is one of the few businesses where you have to be discriminated against based on height, weight, gender, looks, hair
so
color.
Dumb. It's so stupid. Yeah.
And it's one of these things that combined the physical appearance along with the overwhelming draining aspect of 8 shows a week. And I know you're pretty vocal about the 8-show schedule.
I'm so vocal about the 8-show schedule. You put a bottle of wine in any actor and they'll tell you the exact same fucking thing that I've been saying. It's sustainable if you want to be tired all the time. For me, I can't do any other projects that I want to because I'm very much all or nothing. I give my all to my job, and there are other projects I want to do that I can't really half-ass them because I want to have my time to and my whole body to just put myself for those projects. And so you really have to, I would say the hardest thing is to continue a sense of gratitude that I do have a job. Because once you get into the grind of 8 shows, it starts to kind of erode the fact that you do have a job and a fixed income, and it's incredible. And I have to pinch myself and slap myself in the face and go, remember how lucky you are to have this job. Not to say that it's easy. It's extremely difficult. And my voice is always tired and my body's always tired. Still manage to go to work and slay, but I'm always tired in a good way.
Yeah. I mean, it's emotionally exhausting when you are giving yourself, I mean, that's something I think that a lot of people don't realize when they're like, you just go and you do a show and then you go home and you're fine. But actually a muggle friend of mine the other day went to see
Hamilton. I love that. No one's ever said that before. I love that you just said that.
Oh.
I'm going to borrow that from you.
Yeah. A muggle friend, non-musical theater person. We were talking the other day and he's like, yeah, I went to go see Hamilton the other day for the second time. Really cool. Awesome. I'm meaning to ask you. So I went to see a matinee, but there's another cast that does the night show, right?
Another cast, as if. Another cast is 2 shows a week.
Yeah. Yeah. I was like, no, dude, no. And that's not the only day they do 2 shows a day. So you've got your Wednesday, usually your Wednesday 2-show day and your Saturday 2-show day. Oh. And then if you're a Disney show, sometimes you got a Friday 2-show day.
You got a Friday 2-show day.
So... And this blew his mind because he was like, wait, that's like almost a 3-hour show. They just get done and turned around and do it again. I said, well, yeah, welcome
literally,
to the world of Broadway.
Literally.
Yeah, literally. That's what they're doing. And they have a 30-minute nap and they're back at it.
So, that seems like a really nicely timed nap. Sometimes it's like set the alarm for 7 minutes. That's your nap.
Well, okay, so going back, God, I cannot wait to talk about this. Okay, but going back to high school, 15, 16, 17. So 17 is Jimmy Awards, right? And so
Yes. Then
it was Cameron McIntosh that saw that performance?
It was Tara Rubin who saw
it. Tara Rubin, that's what it was.
Tara Rubin.
Yes.
I always say Tara for some reason. It's Tara Rubin who saw the performance. And she was in the audience and... It was, you know, the Jimmys chooses 6 finalists to sing their solo song they've been working on the whole week during the National High School Music Theater Awards. And it just so happened that she was friends with my theater teacher from Northwest School of the Arts. And so after the performance, she came up to me and my theater teacher said, excuse me, do you have an agent? And I was like, I don't even know what that is. Mm-hmm. And so she goes, you have to audition for Miss Saigon. And I was like, great. Okay. And so we set up the auditions and I worked with my auntie who was one of the alternate Kims in the Broadway cast. And then they called and said, okay, this is your time. And my dad drove me up. We had 2 auditions and then.
I'm sitting here with my jaw dropped because
Crazy. You're
at a school for performing arts and you don't know what an agent is.
I didn't really know. I didn't know that it was like I could get one. But I didn't understand like what the process was of like getting a job. So we were we were taught like how to get a job and like, and I guess that was it. And how to want a job, but we weren't taught like anything else.
That's something that I would have hoped would have been fixed. When I'm a few years older than you. And when I got a computer science degree and then was performing with that.
Wow.
So there you go. But I had so many kids that I was performing with when I was a kid, like fresh out of high school and college and whatnot. And they didn't know how to print a headshot or how to market them. They didn't realize that they were a product. They are their own product and they need to market themselves.
It's so dangerous to not know to give your power away at such a young age, excuse me, this is why I don't drink coffee, but you see, I'm going for a second sip. Excuse me, mucus. But it's really dangerous. And I definitely think that it's, I hope that theater education is different because of social media. Like, all anyone gives a shit about is branding yourself. And so I hope what they're focusing on now is substance as a product. You want a quality product, not someone who, you know, anyway. But yeah, I don't remember ever getting taught what the steps were. So thankfully, right. Tara was like, yeah, we'll get you, I'll help you with this, because she's a casting director, massive casting director. I'm just glad that it all was aligned. And actually, this picture was taken the week of the Jimmy Awards. That's me. I don't even look like myself.
It doesn't look like you at all.
It doesn't look like me at all. I'm catfishing myself. No one can see this picture except you, so that's why I wanted to share. We have a secret.
Yay, I love secrets. Secrets are fun. Do you think that just like you're not supposed to get drafted until you're 18 or have a drink in the U.S. until you're 21, that you shouldn't be given the lead in a Broadway show at 17? Or a West End show, sorry. Because,
oh my God.
Again, going to, you get the lead, you go out to London, make your West End debut, which is also only your second show. I think Cameron McIntosh, like, to tell you, so you could learn what the terms were.
Yeah, he put me in Les Mis.
Put you in Les Mis for a few months, right?
Just so you can get used to it. Yeah, which is awesome.
Right. But you're 17, freshly 18, which is, in Europe, you can do anything when you're 18. Awesome.
So dangerous for me.
Right.
That was awesome.
First time out of the country, country, away from your parents, in a professional troupe of debaucherous individuals.
Yep.
And welcome to
the beginning of a great book.
It's also the name of my band, Debaucherous Individuals.
I love that. That's great.
Yeah. Yeah. Which is also the name of my memoir, which is.
Come on.
Yeah. I digress. Yeah. So you're out there and. I guess, did you have time at any point to stop and say, holy no. shit, where am I right now?
The answer is no.
You're shaking your head profusely.
If I could take my hat off and shake it with my hands, I would. No, I didn't. I think the only time that I was like, whoa, this is so cool, is when we opened in Miss Saigon. And back to your original question, I don't recommend anyone doing anything if they don't. How do I say this? I think it depends on the person. I did not know who I was, and I didn't care about taking care of myself. And if that's your mindset, good luck. I learned that the hard way. I only cared about my performance being absolutely perfect and looking the way that they expected me to look. And with all of that surface shit, I completely lost sight of who I was and why I was actually doing this in the first place. And so at that age, when you're going through all of these changes and you have so much responsibility and you're creating a new life for yourself, that was like the last thing I needed to fall under my feet. Like, it felt like the ground just like completely left and I was like falling for years. But the only stability I had was the show. So that began a really toxic relationship I had with doing the show and being perfect, whatever the fuck that word means.
Well, what is it? What did it mean to you then? And what does it mean to you now? What's the difference?
Of performing?
Of being perfect.
I think being perfect is stupid. I think the only time I say perfect is when I make fun of people's accents. Perfect! it's the only time I say that word. But yeah, I think back then, because I thought that that was a thing, I lived in the world of a very dreamy, romantic view of a 18-year-old young woman living in her own world. So like, and as a quintuple Pisces, I romanticize everything. I'll be like, oh my God, this moment. And in my head, I'll be like, I don't know. I'm just so stupid like that in the best way. So when I have no boundaries or structure in my life, I just like, it was too much. But yeah, that was crazy. And I think back then the word perfect meant something and it was like a goal. And now it's just like, I know it's total bullshit. And I guess if you want to say that anything could be perfect in life, it would be having, knowing who you are and being able to hold yourself when you need to. Coming back to the basics, coming back to the ground, so that you can go and open your mind and expand your mind and expand who you are and let go of things. I just didn't understand that relationship you could have with self and how essential it was at a young age, because I was so needed in so many ways by people who really didn't give a shit about my well-being. I thought, oh, that's great. I'm needed. I'm validated. But actually I realized, like, oh, that's not exactly what it turned out to be.
Well, there's therapy that has gotten, at my age now, has gotten me to see that same, I guess, understand that same sort of mindset. But like when I was 17, 18, I was nowhere near any of that. And I think too that, yeah, I would have probably imploded and self-destructed, because you think you're invincible. You really do.
Oh my God, yeah. Yeah, yeah.
And so at what point then did it start to go sort of internal for you? Because, you know, I was reading that you've been vocal about, used to have panic attacks on stage and battled with bulimia for a while.
Yeah.
Do you really? You still have panic attacks?
Still have panic attacks on stage. It's not constant, but, you know, mind vary. My anxiety varies sometimes. Sometimes I feel like it's in control and sometimes I'll be like, I can't breathe. Okay. Don't worry about it. It's fine. I'm having panic attacks. But I've learned how to hone them in, and I've learned how to be with come back to myself and go ask the important questions. Are we in danger? We're okay. You know, it's experience. It's just knowing yourself and knowing what works best for you. But I'm always internal. I've always been internal my whole life. I feel very deeply, and sometimes it's hard for me to get out of that crevice, you know? But I think that I've learned how to use that to my advantage, which means I don't have to look at that heavy feelingness as a downside or a negative thing. But I've always been extremely vocal about the things that have not worked out for me and that have been against me in this industry, because it's important for people to, one, not feel alone, and to remember that it's still a job. Just because you love it so much, it doesn't mean it's not going to hurt you, or that there are things in it that can't hurt you. Because we're not invincible. We're extremely durable. I'm extremely durable. But I'm not invincible. And I think understanding that, I can look at my weaknesses and I can look at my strengths, and I could start to really build up who I am. And the more that I know who I am, the more confident I can be, no matter what the circumstance is, even if it's really fucking shitty.
Is it... The panic attacks on stage, I've heard this from a couple of people that I've talked to, and like Desi Oakley's talked about it, and Patty Murin's talked about it, and multiple people who I love them both. And especially, I'm thinking about Patty's conversation specifically, is she was saying that literally a Disney queen living the dream on stage in front of thousands of people. And all of a sudden she's just like, holy shit, they're all looking at me. And that just...
Yep.
All of a sudden starts to freeze up while like goes on autopilot, and the show doesn't stop. But then inside the mind and the brain is going 1,000 miles a minute.
Oh God. So, yeah, that's a perfect way of describing how it feels.
So that happens with you on Hadestown still too?
Absolutely.
Really?
People's panic and anxiety attacks are rooted in different anxieties and triggers that have happened in the past, different traumas that happened in the past. Mine specifically has to be with body dysmorphia and with bulimia, and related to being on stage. I was forced to lose weight at a young age, and I was forced to look at myself in the mirror and really encourage to say, you're ugly, you need to lose weight, and your skin's horrible. But we love your performance. Your performance is great. Everything else is bullshit. And there were actions that were taken to change all of those things. So, of course, still, as a woman, women's bodies change all the time. There will be times where I'm on stage and I'll go, oh my God, I feel like my arms are like expanding. I feel like my stomach's real. And then I can't breathe. And then I have a panic attack, because those traumas that are so synced for body and stage are so vivid to me still sometimes. Absolutely. Happens all the time. Even in my normal life, it happens all the time.
Well, that's really an interesting dichotomy, I think, because where I'm going with this is through the pandemic, and we're going to get to the whole like performing pandemic stuff probably, but you've been posting lots online about pole dancing. Like, it's mm-hmm. side note, it's an amazing workout, right? Like,
yeah.
full body, very cardiovascular. It's just really, really hard. And it's one of those things, it's a profession where in general, maybe I'm stereotyping, but you do it, like the pole dancing is so that men can sexualize you. And as someone who yeah. has body dysmorphia, right, is there, like, is that in constant conflict? Like, there's the need sort of to be viewed, because you don't have to record and post
no.
either. But you're inspiring.
The need is to not be viewed. And there is a huge stereotype with, and obviously, that was the first time we saw poles and strippers and sexual work and sex workers was so that they could be sexualized because it was a business. I am not a sex worker. I completely support sex workers. I completely support strippers, and I am not a stripper. I pole solely because it's fitness based for me and because mm-hmm. that kind of movement is freeing for me. The lack of clothing is not to be sexualized. It's because we need their skin to grip the pole. That's just right. very plain and simple. you go to any strip club, and of course they're going to be wearing very little clad to nothing because that's their job. Is that they want the goal is to be sexualized, but also so they could stick to the pole to dance and to do tricks. There are different types of pole, but I think. It's just important for me to say that as a pole dancer, I completely support sex workers and strippers. And that I am very in support of that. But no, I don't want to be viewed. The goal is to, and as a man too, you also, I'm sure, have come across a lot of, imagery in the media that puts pressure on you possibly to change your body and that this is the way that mm-hmm. an attractive man looks. And it's all bullshit. And it makes you feel
all
like shit. All the time.
It's
not just women. It's men as well. But women, it sucks because anything we do is sexualized. Fucking breastfeeding is sexualized. It's disgusting. It's like, that's just the disgusting society we live in. So me posting a video of me with a sports bra on and little tiny shorts, sure, people can look at it and say, oh, she's sexualizing herself. That's your point of view. And it makes sense why that's your point of view, because that's the society we live in. It's hyper-sexualized. But that's not my intention for putting it up there. Do I enjoy doing the workout, and do I like posting it to go like, yes, women can do this. I didn't know how to pole dance until about a year and a half ago. And look at the fucking tricks that I'm doing. It's amazing what the mm-hmm. body can do. Absolutely.
It's hard.
Do I also, however, use pole dancing to have a deeper relationship with my body so that I can value it more and find it more beautiful? Absolutely. Those things, so many categories of enjoying your body and realizing how sexy you are that doesn't have to be sexualized. It's just so easy to sexualize anything. I mean, there's a freaking cactus magnet on my fridge, and if I wanted to sexualize that, I can. Like, it's just so dumb. Like, that's just like what our society, that's so stupid.
Oh, I'm going to go out on a date with that cactus magnet sooner or later. We're going to take a short break. Stay tuned for more of the episode. I love how this all kind of plays back to Eurydice a little bit. And I feel like this role is really perfect for you in that it's a strong feminine character that mm-hmm. you're playing it, and possibly and most likely, you know, with the help and the direction of Rachel Chavkin and the rest of the creative team, mm. I mean, Aeneas, everybody, it's just amazing that Eurydice is not some damsel in distress. Yet Eurydice loves love. So there's the soft side, but there's the take no mm-hmm. shit side.
Yeah.
And so how much of that is Eva, and how much of that is what, you know, the creative team, you and the creative team put together for Eurydice?
That's a great question. I feel like Eurydice's taught me so much that, and as somebody who loves the character so much, it's hard for me to not say, oh, we're just like each other. Because then it takes away from an actor's ability to, like, my goal is to go on stage and to not You do not see any Eva. That's besides the point. I'm not on stage to be Eva playing Eurydice. I'm on stage and I'm Eurydice, period.
Mm-hmm.
Like, and we're very, very different beings. But of course, like, if you wanted me to go play frickin' Mufasa, there are things that I can see myself in that character too. You know what I'm saying? Like, that's right. The beauty of humanity. But yeah, I would say that I love that she doesn't put on the damsel in distress. It really just has you look at it in a very real perspective. And actually, Reeve said this in an interview, and I thought I always think about that now, is that any audience member, no matter who they're essentially rooting for when they come into the theater, can really see themselves in every single character.
Mm-hmm.
If there, and you know, maybe there's one that you like kind of go or feel most familiar with, but I see myself in all of the characters as Eva. Eurydice plays an integral part, though, to show you the, I guess, how difficult it is to not be vulnerable. God, we're watching Bats right now, and if I played a drinking game for every time someone says, "I'm really glad they're being vulnerable," I'd be drunk 5 minutes in, for sure. It's so annoying. But it's not the beauty of her vulnerability. It's her the beauty of.
I want to say the authenticity.
I was just going to say being authentic to herself, because she makes a decision. She is not forced to go down to hell. And that's why people are like, Hades a villain. He's not really. He gives her a choice.
Yeah.
And she makes a fucking choice. So, and the fact that, I love that she does it, because a lot of the roles that I played, my characters did not have a choice. Or like they didn't feel like they did, but Eurydice knows that she has a choice. There's
mm-hmm.
there's an extra layer of consciousness that I love that Eurydice has, and throughout the whole show, like there are things that she does because she wants to or she can. Things that the way that she dresses, the what she says, how she fucks with Orpheus when they first meet, and there she's like, "Who are you? Okay, I'm gonna test you to see if you're really like the man you're saying you can be." And it's not because she's being flirty or she's like, "This is the guy for me." She's genuinely saying like, "Okay, what can you provide for me?" And I love that she has that sense of self. I really do. It's really special.
She's got a wherewithal that I don't know if this was intentional or if this comes across because you are bringing a little bit of yourself into the character, but she's wise beyond her years, and she's got this intention and this need to, like you said, Orpheus, prove to me, what can you give me? Can you be the person you're saying that you can you provide for me? Can you do this for me? Like, I'm going to support you. I'm going to choose. But I'm going to support you. Can you choose to support me? And you're like, you're actually having him, Orpheus, test a little bit. And I feel like that's very much sort of echoes in a way how you were sort of shoved into center stage, right? At such a young age.
For sure. I mean, one of Hermes' lines is Eurydice was a young girl, but she saw how the world was.
Yeah.
And it's not that I put myself in Eurydice. It's just that a lot of people have those experiences where you probably know about certain parts of life that I don't. And I probably know about certain parts of life because I've experienced it and you haven't yet. Or you won't. You know, people are so different. And that's I love that beauty. But, I know what that's like because I started so young, and Eurydice knows what that's like because she has had to live very survivalist life from such a young age. And it's not me putting myself into the character. It's like, oh yeah, I do know what that's like. Awesome. Yeah. So cool. I do know what that's like.
Yeah. Yeah. I love that. I mean, it comes across, it's very much just like there's a worldly wise to Eurydice and an acceptance of like, I'm making this choice and I'm okay with the outcome. I feel like that's very much what I see from you and what I know about you from a distance is I feel like that's sort of how you are as well. You're just like, well, I'm going to evaluate it. I'm going to get all my options. I'm going to make a choice and then I'm going to stick with it. And actually you said this in the beginning, you're like, you're all or nothing. You can't do two things at once.
I am very all or nothing, but I appreciate that. Thank you so much for saying that. About the show, but yeah, I will say though, I have my brain in my way works so fast. I see all the options and I go based off what I know is right for me and what I feel is right for me. And I will say 99% of the time is what I feel is right for me. Cause I don't know what's what's going to happen in the future. I mean, I don't have, I wish I was like, that'd be actually really fucked up. But I really go based off of feeling a lot of the time. That's like kind of how I like maneuver my way through life. It's just based off feeling.
Well, it's a good way to go. It's the energy. You're following the positive energy pulling you forward, which I have another podcast called Was It Chance, where we talk about people following that creative energy and manifesting their own opportunity. Yeah, so
that's
it's
so great.
It's totally sort of the same thing. But then also going back to like sort of the emotional uncertainty of that time, coming out of Miss Saigon and before Hadestown and whatnot, like you got married and divorced at such a young age as well.
I did.
Yeah. So, I mean, I don't really know what to ask to start talking about that, but I want to acknowledge
it's a very simple explanation. I had a boyfriend. I was very young. He proposed. I got scared. I was 21 years old. And I said yes, because that's a lot of pressure and I didn't know what else to say. And it happened. And if I go back in time, I wish I could have said, you know, that you can say no. Like, that's an option. You can say no. But it made sense why I said yes, because there was never a time in my life where I could say no to all the fucked up shit that people were making me do. Lose weight. We're going to send you free meals to your door. Go on a contraception. Okay. I always said yes, because I there was a level of performance that I thought I had to achieve off stage. So I completely understand why I said yes.
Oh, you said, and you were scared. What were you scared of?
Well, it's a big decision. Saying no to a person who you've been in a relationship with, that's huge. I still didn't know who I was. And it wasn't a toxic relationship, but it was comfortable. So of course, would I say no to being not comfortable? And those were the questions I was asking, because I didn't know. I didn't know the complexities of a relationship and how I brought myself into them and how I was changing. I didn't realize that, because I was in a routine. I was in a groove. Mm-hmm. I like I said before, I hadn't yet developed truly my sense of self and my ability to set boundaries and my ability to say no and not care about what disturbances that caused. That was a big thing. I could see the outcome. If I had said no, which I originally wanted, I did, essentially. I thought, oh God, this would happen. These people would be upset. I would lose these friends. This person would not, like, I thought about all those things. Of course I did. So I made the decision based off fear. Fear of causing a disruption and fear of not of taking up space in a way that really benefited me and just me, because I thought that was selfish. Big lesson, everyone. Big lesson.
You got to put yourself first. Otherwise, you're going to always just...
Well, now I fucking know that. But you'd be 21 years old on a beach in Tulum when you're paying for the whole vacation and someone proposes to you and you've never even talked about marriage before. And you're comfortable.
My goodness.
You'd be like, like, that's exactly how I felt. Yeah.
Wow.
I don't say I have any regrets, because I wouldn't obviously be who I am now, the lessons I've learned. But I will say that it happens. And it just so happens that you know about it because fucking press.
Yeah.
And social media. You wouldn't know it any other way.
Press and social. Yeah. Press and social media. Yeah. Like, God, they talk about everything. There's an obsession. I think there's an unhealthy obsession in this country with.
Of course. It's unhealthy because people have, our society doesn't encourage people to know who the fuck they are. Because if they really cared about who they are and what's good for them, then they wouldn't give a shit what who's getting divorced and who's dating who now and relationship drama. Like, they wouldn't care, because it doesn't mean anything.
I think it's like, because half the world is on, maybe it's country. I'll generalize our country. Half the country's on Prozac, probably more. I don't know. I don't actually know the statistics.
Probably. But, I don't even know what that is. I don't even know what that is, man.
Prozac, antidepressant.
Okay.
Generic antidepressant. It's been around for years. I feel like there is so much internalization. Like you said, what we were talking about a second ago is that you walk down the street and there's guys with 10-pack abs and girls with perfect boobs and this thin body. And always we're trying to get sold something by by being told what who we are is not good enough.
Yeah, because we live in a very dumbass capitalist system that tells everyone, a certain group of people, you're perfect, you're the elite. Everyone follow you. We get money, you get money. Everyone else, fucking losers, fix yourselves. You can't get this, you can't have this opportunity because you're from here. It's so, the way that it's set up is actually, we're not even gonna get to that. We don't have the time.
Oh God, yeah. I wish I could talk to you forever. You're amazing. But I guess this is a good place to stop. Oh, actually, no. Before we stop, I want to go full circle and take it back to your parents. They originally wanted you, of course, to be the financially stable individual, but
sports.
Now,
yeah,
sports. Be a sports star.
Which I don't understand because there would still be such a small percentage that I would make a good living off doing fucking BMX. But bless my dad, he was like, he just really wanted to see me succeed in something. And yeah.
So when, have they come around now and they've been like, you know, Eva, we're proud of you. We're great. This is awesome.
Are you kidding me? Of course they have, because I'm like, what do you want for Christmas? TV? Done. Of course they love, no, I'm joking. No, they knew deep down that it was about trust. And of course it took them a long time because I was their first baby. Mm-hmm. And they want their baby to, and they were so young. My mom had me when she was 17, 18. So they still, of course, were like, we wouldn't want you to do what we wouldn't do. And I'm like, well, you haven't had a chance to know what you would not do. So let me be me. That was kind of how I felt. But of course, the second that they saw me in that environment of performing and singing, they were like, okay, she's happy, and that's all we could ever ask for.
Wow, yeah, I love that, and I'm happy for you.
Thank you. I'm very grateful to have a very supportive family. That's for sure.
Yep. All right, so we'll wrap up with three standard closing questions I ask everybody. The first one, just very simply, is what motivates you?
What motivates me? I'm now a mother to a beautiful little dog who's asleep on the couch with literally 50 toys. So that at the moment motivates me, because getting a dog really distracted me from getting caught in the cycle of depression, anxiety, not permanently on all the time, but a lot of the time. So it motivates me to remind myself that there is more to my life than how I feel. Cause sometimes it's shit. And then I think everything's shit. It's like, no, let's not do that. So that motivates me. And also, the people in my life, the people that I love, that love me, motivate me. And also my young self motivates me. I look at that picture I showed you a lot actually lately. And I go, she would be so proud of where we are and who we are today. So that motivates me.
Well, that leads to my next question, is what advice would you give to your younger self and younger people listening now, starting out down a similar path?
Oh, see, I love this question, because I wouldn't give my younger self any advice, because I think it's cheating. I think it's like, let your younger self have, at least for me, this is my personal experience. She needed to do those things, because innately younger me knew what the right thing for her was. She was just scared to take up space and do what was right for her solely. But we learned a lesson in a really great way. And hey, it's a fucking punchline now. I'm divorced. Hello, that's hilarious. And I'm 2-time Tony Nominee, 2-time loser. Like, it's funny. We're writing our memoir. That's what I want to say to younger me. Do you? It's going to make a great book one day. I do have a thing where if I could go back in time, I would dress as like really older me and like scare the shit out of my younger self. That's probably what I would do. And be like something like, I don't know, like make it seem like really witchy, like, don't, you know, I don't know. I'd fuck with myself, younger self, more than I would get with advice.
Okay. So last question then. If you could only see one show for the rest of your life, but you can see it as many times as you want, what would you see?
MJ the Musical.
Oh my God. So good, right? So good.
That's all I have to say.
Objectively, one of the best shows I have seen, hands down. Yeah.
That's just all I have to say.
Phenomenal. All right. Where can we find you on social media?
Oh God. You can find me on Instagram at Liviva Maria, and also on Twitter at Eva Blazada. But no pressure. I don't care if you follow me or not. It's your choice.
I think you should.
The world still revolves.
Yeah, you post some good stuff. All right. You can find more of me at thetheaterpodcast.com. I'm on Instagram and Twitter at @theater_podcast. On Facebook, who uses that? Facebook.com/official theater podcast. Leave a rating and a review wherever you're listening now. This has been edited by Well-Rounded Hoodlum Productions. Jukebox the Ghost gave you the music you're listening to right now. And Eva Noblezada, thank you so much for joining us today.
Hey, it's Leslie Odom Jr. here on the Broadway Podcast Network to tell you about the RISE Theater Directory, a program of Maestro Music. RISE is a national online resource designed to connect and empower backstage and administrative and creative theater professionals from underrepresented backgrounds. If you work or aspire to work in the theater community, this can help you find your next project. And if you hire theater professionals, search the RISE Theater Directory to find your next team. Create your profile now and get more information by visiting risetheater.org. That's theater with an RISETHEATRE.org, because only together we rise.